at the Naval Academy. He could have gotten 5 times the rent from someone else, but he didn't want any wild parties in his home. The officer was a Bible thumper from Kansas, and made an acceptable custodian. 5.5 hours of sleep in the past 30? Something like that. He was too tired to look at his watch. It wasn't fair. Sleeplessness murders judgment. But it made little sense telling himself that, and telling the Admiral would make less. He was in Greer's office 5 minutes later.
Sorry to have to wake you up, Jack.
Oh, that's all right, sir, Ryan returned the lie. What's up?
Come on over and grab some coffee. It's going to be a long day.
Ryan dropped his topcoat on the sofa and walked over to pour a mug of Navy brew. He decided against Coffee Mate or sugar. Better to endure it naked and get the caffeine full force.
Any place I can shave around here, sir?
Heads behind the office door, over in the corner. Greer handed him a yellow sheet torn from a telex machine. Look at this. Top secret. 10220Z 38976. NSA SIGINT Bulletin. Rednav Ops. Message follows. At 083145Z, NSA monitor stations, deleted, deleted, and deleted, recorded an ELF broadcast from Red Fleet ELF facility, Semipalapinsk, XX, message, duration 10 minutes, XX, 6 elements, XX. ELF signal is evaluated as prep broadcast to Red Fleet submarines at sea, XX. At 090000Z, an all-ships broadcast was made by Red Fleet Headquarters Central Commo Station Tula and Satellites 3 and 5, XX, bands used. HF, VHF, UHF, XX. Message duration, 39 seconds, with 2 repeats. Identical content made at 091000Z and 092000Z, XX, 475, 5-element cipher groups, XX. Signal coverage as follows. Northern Fleet Area, Baltic Fleet Area, and Med Squadron Area, XX. Note, Far East Fleet, not, repeat, not affected by this broadcast, XX. Numerous acknowledgement signals emanated from addresses in areas cited above, XX. Origin and traffic analysis to follow, XX. Not completed at this time, XX. Beginning at 10000Z, NSA monitor station, deleted, deleted, and deleted, recorded increased HF and VHF traffic at Red Fleet bases Polyarny, Severomorsk, Pechenga, Tallinn, Kronstadt, and Eastern Med Area, XX. Additional HF and VHF traffic from Red Fleet assets at sea, XX. Amplification to follow, XX. Evaluation. A major unplanned Red Fleet operation has been ordered with fleet assets reporting availability and status, XX. End bulletin. NSA sends. 102215Z. Break, break. Ryan looked at his watch.
Fast work by the boys at NSA, and fast work by our duty watch officers, getting everybody up.
He drained his mug and went over for a refill.
What's the word on signal traffic analysis?
Here. Greer handed him a second telex sheet. Ryan scanned it.
That's a lot of ships. Must be nearly everything they have at sea. Not much on the ones in port, though.
Landline, Greer observed. The ones in port can phone Fleet Ops, Moscow. By the way, that is every ship they have at sea in the Western Hemisphere. Every damned one. Any ideas?
Let's see. We have that increased activity in the Barents Sea. Looks like a medium-sized ASW exercise. Maybe they're expanding it. Doesn't explain the increased activity in the Baltic and Med, though. Did they have a war game laid on?
Nope. They just finished Crimson Storm a month ago.
Ryan nodded.
Yeah, they usually take a couple of months to evaluate that much data. And who'd want to play games up there at this time of year? The weather's supposed to be a bitch. Have they ever run a major game in December?
Not a big one. But most of these acknowledgements are from submarines, son. And subs don't care a whole lot about the weather.
Well,
Given some other preconditions, you might call this ominous. No idea what the signal said, eh?
No. They're using computer-based ciphers, same as us. If the spooks at the NSA can read them, they're not telling me about it.
In theory, the National Security Agency came under the titular control of the Director of Central Intelligence. In fact, it was a law unto itself.
That's what traffic analysis is all about, Jack. You try to guess intentions by who's talking to whom.
Yes, sir, but when everybody's talking to everybody...
Yeah.
Anything else on alert? Their army? Voyska PVO?
Ryan referred to the Soviet Air Defense Network.
Nope. Just the fleet. Subs, ships, and naval aviation.
Ryan stretched.
That makes it sound like an exercise, sir.
We'll want a little more data on what they're doing, though. Have you talked to Admiral Davenport?
That's the next step. Haven't had time. I've only been in long enough to shave myself and turn the coffee on.
Greer sat down and set his phone receiver in the desk speaker before punching in the numbers.
Vice Admiral Davenport.
The voice was curt.
Morning, Charlie. James here. Did you get the NSA 976?
Sure did, but that's not what's got me up. Our SOSIS-NET went berserk a few hours ago.
Oh? Greer looked at the phone, then at Ryan.
Yeah, nearly every sub they have at sea just put the pedal to the metal, and all at about the same time.
Doing what exactly, Charlie? Greer prompted.
We're still figuring that out. Looks like a lot of boats are heading into the North Atlantic. The units in the Norwegian Sea are racing southwest. Three from the Western Med are heading that way, too. But we haven't got a clear picture yet. We need a few more hours.
What do they have operating off our coast, sir? Ryan asked.
They woke you up, Ryan.
Good. Two old Novembers. One's a Raven conversion doing an E-lint job off the Cape. The other one's sitting off Kings Bay making a damn nuisance of itself.
Ryan smiled to himself. An American or Allied ship was a she. The Russians used the male pronoun for a ship, and the intelligence community usually referred to a Soviet ship as it.
There's a Yankee boat, Davenport went on, 1,000 miles south of Iceland, and the initial report is that it's heading north.
Probably wrong. Reciprocal bearing, transcription error, something like that. We're checking. Must be a goof, because it was heading south earlier.
Ryan looked up.
What about their other missile boats?
Their deltas and typhoons are in the Barents Sea, and the Sea of Okhotsk, as usual. No news on them.
Oh, we have attack boats up there, of course, but Gallery doesn't want them to break radio silence. And he's right. So all we have at the moment is the report on the stray Yankee.
What are we doing, Charlie? Greer asked.
Gallery has a general alert out to his boats. They're standing by in case we need to redeploy. NORAD has gone to a slightly increased alert status, they tell me. Davenport referred to the North American Aerospace Defense Command. Sinklant and Sinkpak fleet staffs are up and running around in circles, like you'd expect. Some extra P-3s are working out of Iceland. Nothing much else at the moment. First, we have to figure out what they're up to.
Okay, keep me posted.
Roger. If we hear anything, I'll let you know. And I trust...
We will.
Greer killed the phone. He shook a finger at Ryan.
Don't you go to sleep on me, Jack.
On top of this stuff?
Ryan waved his mug.
You're not concerned, I see.
Sir, there's nothing to be concerned about yet. It's, what, 1 p.m. over there now? Probably some admiral, maybe old Sergei himself, decided to toss a drill at his boys. He wasn't supposed to be all that pleased with how Crimson Storm worked out, and maybe he decided to rattle a few cages, ours included, of course. Hell, their Army and Air Force aren't involved, and it's for damn sure that if they were planning anything nasty, the other services would know about it. We'll have to keep an eye on this, but so far I don't see anything to...
Ryan almost said lose sleep over.
Sweat about.
How old were you at Pearl Harbor?
My father was 19, sir. He didn't marry until after the war, and I wasn't the first little Ryan.
Jack smiled.
Greer knew all of this. As I recall, you weren't all that old yourself.
I was a seaman second on the old Texas.
Greer had never made it into that war. Soon after it started, he'd been accepted by the Naval Academy. By the time he had graduated from there and finished training at submarine school, the war was almost over. He reached the Japanese coast on his first cruise the day after the war ended.
But you know what I mean.
Indeed I do, sir. And that's why we have the CIA, DIA, NSA, and NRO, among others. If the Ruskies can fool all of us, maybe we ought to read up on our marks. All those subs heading into the Atlantic. I feel better with the word that the Yankee is heading north. They've had enough time to make that a hard piece of data. Davenport probably doesn't want to believe it without confirmation. If Ivan was looking to play hardball, that Yankee'd be heading south. The missiles on those old boats can't reach very far. So, we stay up and watch. Fortunately, sir, you make a decent cup of coffee. How does breakfast grab you? Might as well. If we can finish up on the Afghanistan stuff, maybe I can fly back tomorrow. Tonight? You still might. Maybe this way you'll learn to sleep on the plane. Breakfast was sent up 20 minutes later. Both men were accustomed to big ones, and the food was surprisingly good. Ordinarily, CIA cafeteria food was government undistinguished, and Ryan wondered if the night crew, with fewer people to serve, might have taken the time to do their job right. Or maybe they had sent out for it. The two men sat around until Davenport phoned at 6:45. It's definite. All the boomers are heading towards port. We have good tracks on 2 Yankees, 3 Deltas, and a Typhoon. Memphis reported in when her Delta took off for home at 20 knots after being on station for 5 days, and then Gallery queried Queenfish. Same story. Looks like they're all headed for the barn. Also, we just got some photos from a big bird pass over the fjord. For once, it wasn't covered with clouds, and we have a bunch of surface ships with bright infrared signatures, like they're getting steam up. How about Red October? Ryan asked. Nothing. Maybe our information was bad, and she didn't sail. Wouldn't be the first time. You don't suppose they've lost her? Ryan wondered aloud. Davenport had already thought of that. That would explain the activity up north. But what about the Baltic and Med business? 2 years ago, we had that scare with Tullaby, Ryan pointed out. And the CNO was so furious, he threw an all-hands rescue drill on both oceans. Maybe, Davenport conceded. The blood in Norfolk was supposed to have been ankle-deep after that fiasco. The USS Tullaby, a small one-of-a-kind attack sub, had long carried a reputation for bad luck. In this case, it had spilled over onto a lot of others. Anyway, it looks a whole lot less scary than it did 2 hours back. They wouldn't be recalling their boomers if they were planning anything against us, would they? Ryan said. I see that Ryan still has your crystal ball, James. That's why I pay him for, Charlie.
Still, it is odd, Ryan commented. Why recall all of the missile boats? Have they ever done this before? What about the ones in the Pacific?
Haven't heard about those yet, Davenport replied. I've asked SyncPAC for our data, but they haven't got back to me yet. On the other question, no, they've never recalled all their boomers at once, but they do occasionally reshuffle all their positions at once. That's probably what this is. I said they're heading towards port, not into it. We won't know that for a couple of days.
What if they're afraid they've lost one? Ryan ventured.
No such luck, Davenport scoffed. They haven't lost a boomer since the Gulf we lifted off Hawaii, back when you were in high school, Ryan. Ramius is too good a skipper to let that happen.
So was Captain Smith of the Titanic, Ryan thought.
Thanks for the info, Charlie. Greer hung up. Looks like you were right, Jack. Nothing to worry about. Let's get that data on Afghanistan in here. And just for the hell of it, we'll look at Charlie's pictures of their northern fleet when we're finished.
10 minutes later, a messenger arrived with a cart from Central Files. Greer was the sort who liked to see the raw data himself. This suited Ryan. He'd known a few analysts who had based their reports on selective data and been cut off at the knees for it by this man. The information on the cart was from a variety of sources, but to Ryan, the most significant were the tactical radio intercepts from listening posts on the Pakistani border, and, he gathered, from inside Afghanistan itself. The nature and tempo of Soviet operations did not indicate a backing off, as seemed to be suggested by a pair of recent articles in Red Star and some intelligence sources inside the Soviet Union. They spent 3 hours reviewing the data.
I think Sir Basil is placing too much stock in political intelligence and too little in what our listening posts are getting in the field. It would not be unprecedented for the Soviets not to let their field commanders know what's going on in Moscow, of course, but on the whole, I do not see a clear picture, Ryan concluded. The Admiral looked at him.
I pay you for answers, Jack.
Sir, the truth is that Moscow moved in there by mistake. We know that from both military and political intelligence reports. The tenor of the data is pretty clear. From where I sit, I don't see that they know what they want to do. In a case like this, the bureaucratic mind finds it most easy to do nothing. So their field commanders are told to continue the mission, while the senior party bosses fumble around looking for a solution and covering their asses for getting into the mess in the first place.
Okay, so we know that we don't know.
Yes, sir, I don't like it either, but saying anything else would be a lie.
The Admiral snorted. There was a lot of that at Langley. Intelligence types giving answers when they didn't even know the questions.
Ryan was still new enough to the game that when he didn't know, he said so.
Greer wondered if that would change in time. He hoped not.
After lunch, a package arrived by messenger from the National Reconnaissance Office. It contained the photographs taken earlier in the day on two successive passes by a KH-11 satellite. They'd be the last such photos for a while because of the restrictions imposed on orbital mechanics and the generally miserable weather on the Kola Peninsula. The first set of visible light shots, taken an hour after the flash signal had gone out from Moscow, showed the fleet at anchor or tied to the docks. On infrared, a number of them were glowing brightly from internal heat, indicating that their boilers or gas turbine engines were operating. The second set of photos had been taken on the next orbital pass at a very low angle. Ryan scrutinized the blow-ups.
Wow! Kirov, Moskva, Kiev, 3 Karas, 5 Krestas, 4 Krivaks, 8 Udalois, and 5 Savramenes.
Search and rescue, eh? Greer gave Ryan a hard look. Look at the bottom here. Every fast oiler they have is following them out. That's most of the striking force of the Northern Fleet right there. And if they need oilers, they figure to be out for a while.
Davenport could have been more specific, but we still have their boomers heading back in. No amphibious ships in this photo, just combatants. Only the new ones, too. The ones with range and speed.
And the best weapons.
Yeah, Ryan nodded. And all scrambled in a few hours.
Sir, if they had this planned in advance, we'd have known about it. This must have been laid on today.
Interesting.
You've picked up the English habit of understatement, Jack.
Greer stood up to stretch.
I want you to stay over an extra day.
Okay, sir. He looked at his watch. Mind if I phone the wife? I don't want her to drive out to the airport for a plane I'm not on.
Sure. And after you finish that, I want you to go down and see someone at DIA who used to work for me. See how much operational data they're getting on this sortie. If this is a drill, we'll know soon enough, and you can still take your surfing Barbie home tomorrow.
It was a skiing Barbie, but Ryan didn't say so.
The sixth day. Wednesday, 8th December. CIA Headquarters. Ryan had been to the office of the Director of Central Intelligence several times before to deliver briefings and occasional personal messages from Sir Basil Charleston to His Highness, the DCI. It was larger than Greer's, with a better view of the Potomac Valley, and appeared to have been decorated by a professional in a style compatible with the DCI's origins. Arthur Moore was a former judge of the Texas State Supreme Court, and the room reflected his southwestern heritage. He and Admiral Greer were sitting on a sofa near the picture windows. Greer waved Ryan over and passed him a folder. The folder was made of red plastic and had a snap closure. Its edges were bordered with white tape, and the cover had a simple white paper label bearing the legend, Eyes Only, Triangle, and Willow. Neither notation was unusual. A computer in the basement of the Langley headquarters selected random names at the touch of a key. This prevented a foreign agent from inferring anything from the name of an operation. Ryan opened the folder and looked first at the index sheet. Evidently, there were only 3 copies of the Willow document, each initialed by its owner. This one was initialed by the DCI himself. A CIA document with only 3 copies was unusual enough that Ryan, whose highest clearance was Nebula, had never encountered one. From the grave looks of Moore and Greer, he guessed that these were 2 of the triangle-cleared officers. The other, he assumed, was the Deputy Director of Operations, DDO, another Texan named Robert Ritter. Ryan turned the index sheet. The report was a Xeroxed copy of something that had been typed on a manual machine, and it had too many strikeovers to have been done by a real secretary.
If Nancy Cummings and the other elite executive secretaries had not been allowed to see this... Ryan looked up.
It's all right, Jack, Greer said. You've just been cleared for Willow.
Ryan sat back and, despite his excitement, began to read the document slowly and carefully. The agent's code name was actually Cardinal, the highest-ranking agent in place the CIA had ever had. He was the stuff that legends are made of. Cardinal had been recruited more than 20 years earlier by Oleg Penkovsky, another legend, a dead one. Penkovsky had at the time been a colonel in the GRU, the Soviet Military Intelligence Agency, a larger and more active counterpart to America's Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA. His position had given him access to daily information on all facets of the Soviet military, from the Red Army's command structure to the operational status of intercontinental missiles. The information he smuggled out through his British contact, Greville Wynne, was supremely valuable, and Western countries had come to depend on it. Too much. Penkovsky was discovered during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. It was his data, ordered and delivered under great pressure and haste, that told President Kennedy that Soviet strategic systems were not ready for war. This information enabled the president to back Khrushchev into a corner from which there was no easy exit. The famous blink ascribed to Kennedy's steady nerves was, as in many such events throughout history, facilitated by his ability to see the other man's cards. This advantage was given him by a courageous agent whom he would never meet. Penkovsky's response to the flash request from Washington was too rash. Already under suspicion, this finished him. He paid for his treason with his life. It was Cardinal who first learned that he was being watched more closely than was the norm for a society where everyone is watched. He warned Penkovsky too late. When it became clear that the colonel could not be extracted from the Soviet Union, he himself urged Cardinal to betray him. It was the final ironic joke of a brave man that his own death would advance the career of an agent whom he had recruited. Cardinal's job was necessarily as secret as his name. A senior advisor and confidant of a Politburo member, Cardinal often acted as his representative within the Soviet military establishment. He thus had access to political and military intelligence of the highest order. This made his information extraordinarily valuable and, paradoxically, highly suspect. Those few experienced CIA case officers who knew of him found it impossible to believe that he had not been turned somewhere along the line by one of the thousands of KGB counterintelligence officers whose sole duty it is to watch everyone and everything. For this reason, Cardinal-coded material was generally cross-checked against the reports of other spies and sources. But he had outlived many small-fry agents. The name Cardinal was known in Washington only to the top three CIA executives. On the first day of each month, a new code name was chosen for his data, a name made known only to the highest echelon of CIA officers and analysts. This month, it was Willow. Before being passed on, grudgingly, to outsiders, Cardinal data was laundered as carefully as mafia income to disguise its source. There were also a number of security measures that protected the agent and were unique to him. For fear of cryptographic exposure of his identity, Cardinal material was hand-delivered, never transmitted by radio or landline. Cardinal himself was a very careful man. Penkovsky's fate had taught him that. His information was conveyed through a series of intermediaries to the chief of the CIA's Moscow station. He had outlived 12 station chiefs. One of these, a retired field officer, had a brother who was a Jesuit. Every morning, the priest, an instructor in philosophy and theology at Fordham University in New York, said Mass for the safety and the soul of a man whose name he would never know. It was as good an explanation as any for Cardinal's continued survival. 4 separate times he had been offered extraction from the Soviet Union. Each time, he had refused. To some, this was proof that he'd been turned, but to others, it was proof that, like most successful agents, Cardinal was a man driven by something he alone knew, and therefore, like most successful agents, he was probably a little crazy. The document Ryan was reading had been in transit for 20 hours. It had taken 5 for the film to reach the American Embassy in Moscow, where it was delivered at once to the station chief. An experienced field officer and former reporter for the New York Times, he worked under the cover of Press Attaché. He developed the film himself in his private darkroom. 30 minutes after its arrival, he inspected the 5 exposed frames through a magnifying glass and sent a flash priority dispatch to Washington saying that a cardinal signal was en route. Next, he transcribed the message from the film to flash paper on his own portable typewriter, translating from the Russian as he went. This security measure erased both the agent's handwriting and, by the paraphrasing automatic to translation, any personal peculiarities of his language. The film was then burned to ashes. The report folded into a metal container much like a cigarette case. This held a small pyrotechnic charge that would go off if the case were improperly opened or suddenly shaken. 2 cardinal signals had been lost when their cases were accidentally dropped. Next, the station chief took the case to the embassy's courier-in-residence, who had already been booked on a 3-hour Aeroflot flight to London. At Heathrow Airport, the courier sprinted to make connections with a Pan Am 747 to New York's Kennedy International, where he connected with the Eastern Shuttle to Washington's National Airport. By 8 that morning, the diplomatic bag was in the State Department. There, a CIA officer removed the case, drove it immediately to Langley, and handed it to the DCI. It was opened by an instructor from the CIA's Technical Services Branch. The DCI made 3 copies on his personal Xerox machine and burned the flash paper in his ashtray. These security measures had struck a few of the men who had succeeded to the office of the DCI as laughable. The laughs had never outlasted the first cardinal report. When Ryan finished the report, he referred back to the second page and read it through again, shaking his head slowly. The Willow document was the strongest reinforcement yet of his desire not to know how intelligence information reached him. He closed the folder and handed it back to Admiral Greer.
Christ, sir.
Jack, I know I don't have to say this, but what you have just read, nobody, not the President, not Sir Basil, not God if he asks, nobody learns of it without the authorization of the Director. Is that understood?
Greer had not lost his command voice.
Yes, sir.
Ryan bobbed his head like a schoolboy. Judge Moore pulled a cigar from his jacket pocket and lit it, looking past the flame into Ryan's eyes. The judge, everyone said, had been a hell of a field officer in his day. He'd worked with Hans Toft during the Korean War and had been instrumental in bringing off one of the CIA's legendary missions, the disappearance of a Norwegian ship that had been carrying a cargo of medical personnel and supplies for the Chinese. The loss had delayed a Chinese offensive for several months, saving thousands of American and Allied lives, but it had been a bloody operation. All of the Chinese personnel and all of the Norwegian crewmen had vanished. It was a bargain in the simple mathematics of war, but the morality of the mission was another matter. For this reason, or perhaps another, Moore had soon thereafter left government service to become a trial lawyer in his native Texas. His career had been spectacularly successful, and he'd advanced from wealthy courtroom lawyer to distinguished appellate judge. He'd been recalled to the CIA 3 years earlier because of his unique combination of absolute personal integrity and experience in black operations. Judge Moore hid a Harvard Law degree and a highly ordered mind behind the facade of a West Texas cowboy, something he had never been, but simulated with ease.
"So, Dr. Ryan, what do you think of this?"
Moore said as the deputy director of operations came in.
"Hi, Bob. Come on over here. We just showed Ryan here the Willow file."
"Oh?" Ritter slid a chair over, neatly trapping Ryan in the corner.
"And what does the Admiral's fair-haired boy think of that?"
"Gentlemen, I assume that you all regard this information as genuine," Ryan said cautiously, getting nods. "Sir, if this information was hand-delivered by the Archangel Michael, I'd have trouble believing it. But since you gentlemen say it's reliable..." They wanted his opinion. The problem was his conclusion was too incredible. "Well," he decided, "I've gotten this far by giving my honest opinions." Ryan took a deep breath and gave them his evaluation.
"Very well, Dr. Ryan," Judge Moore nodded sagaciously.
"First, I want to hear what else it might be.
then I want you to defend your analysis.
Sir, the most obvious alternative doesn't bear much thinking about. Besides, they've been able to do it since Friday, and they haven't done it, Ryan said, keeping his voice low and reasonable. Ryan had trained himself to be objective. He ran through the four alternatives he had considered, careful to examine each in detail. This was no time to allow personal views to intrude on his thinking. He spoke for 10 minutes.
I suppose there's one more possibility, Judge, he concluded. This could be disinformation aimed at blowing the source. I cannot evaluate that possibility.
The thought has occurred to us. All right, now that you've gone this far, you might as well give your operational recommendation.
Sir, the Admiral can tell you what the Navy'll say.
I sort of figured that one out, boy, Moore laughed. What do you think?
Judge, setting up the decision tree on this will not be easy. There are too many variables, too many possible contingencies. But I'd say yes. If it's possible, if we can work out the details, we ought to try. The biggest question is the availability of our own assets. Do we have the pieces in place?
Greer answered.
Our assets are slim. One carrier, Kennedy. I checked. Saratoga's in Norfolk, with an engineering casualty. On the other hand, HMS Invincible was just over here for that NATO exercise. Sailed from Norfolk Monday night. Admiral White, I believe, commanding a small battle group.
Lord White, sir? Ryan asked. The Earl of Weston?
You know him? Moore asked.
Well, yes, sir. Our wives are friendly. I shot grouse with him in Scotland last September. He makes noises like a good operator, and I hear he has a good reputation.
You're thinking we might want to borrow their ships, James? Moore asked. If so, we'll have to tell them about this, but we'll have to tell our side first. There's a meeting of the National Security Council at 1 this afternoon. Ryan, you will prepare the briefing papers and deliver the briefing yourself.
Ryan blinked.
That's not much time, sir.
James here says you work well under pressure. Prove it.
He looked at Greer.
Get a copy of his briefing papers and be ready to fly to London. That's the President's decision. If we want their boats, we'll have to tell them why. That means briefing the Prime Minister, and that's your job. Bob, I want you to confirm this report. Do what you have to. But do not get Willow involved.
Right, Ritter replied.
Moore looked at his watch. We'll meet back here at 3:30, depending on how the meeting goes. Ryan, you have 90 minutes. Get cracking.
What am I being measured for? Ryan wondered.
There was talk in the CIA that Judge Moore would be leaving soon for a comfortable ambassadorship, perhaps to the court of St. James, a fitting reward for a man who had worked long and hard to reestablish a close relationship with the British. If the judge left, Admiral Greer would probably move into this office. He had the virtues of age, he wouldn't be around that long, and friends on Capitol Hill. Ritter had neither. He had complained too long and too openly about congressmen who leaked information on his operations and his field agents, getting men killed in the process of demonstrating their importance on the local cocktail circuit. He also had an ongoing feud with the chairman of the Select Intelligence Committee. With that sort of reshuffling at the top and this sudden access to new and fantastic information, what does it mean for me? Ryan asked himself. They couldn't want him to be the next DDI. He knew he didn't have anything like the experience required for that job, though maybe in another 5 or 6 years.
Requienus Ridge.
Romius inspected his status board. The Red October was heading southwest on Track 8, the westernmost surveyed route, on what Northern Fleet submarines called Gorshkov's Railroad. His speed was 13 knots. It never occurred to him that this was an unlucky number, an Anglo-Saxon superstition. They would hold this course and speed for another 20 hours. Immediately behind him, Komarov was seated at the submarine's gravitometer board, a large rolled chart behind him. The young lieutenant was chain-smoking and looked tense as he ticked off their position on the chart. Romius did not disturb him. Komarov knew his job, and Borodin would relieve him in another 2 hours. Installed in the Red October's keel was a highly sensitive device called a gradiometer. Essentially two large lead weights separated by a space of 100 yards. A laser computer system measured the space between the weights down to a fraction of an angstrom.
distortions of that distance or lateral movement of the weights indicated variations in the local gravitational field. The navigator compared these highly precise local values to the values of his chart. With careful use of gravitometers in the ship's inertial navigation system, he could plot the vessel's location to within 100 meters, half the length of the ship. The mass sensing system was being added to all submarines that could accommodate it. The younger attack boat commanders, Ramius knew, had used it to run the railroad at high speed. Good for the commander's ego, Ramius judged, but a little hard on the navigator. He felt no need for recklessness. Perhaps the letter had been a mistake. No, it prevented second thoughts, and the sensor suites on the attack submarines simply were not good enough to detect the Red October so long as he maintained his silent routine. Ramius was certain of this. He had used them all. He would get where he wanted to go, to do what he wanted to do, and nobody, not his own countrymen, not even the Americans, would be able to do a thing about it. That's why earlier he had listened to the passage of an Alpha 30 miles to his east, and smiled. The White House. Judge Moore's CIA car was a Cadillac limousine that came with a driver and a security man who kept an Uzi submachine gun under the dashboard. The driver turned right off Pennsylvania Avenue onto Executive Drive. More a parking lot than a street, this served the needs of senior officials and reporters who worked at the White House and the Executive Office Building. Old State, that shining example of institutional grotesque that towered over the Executive Mansion. The driver pulled smoothly into a vacant VIP slot and jumped out to open the doors after the security man had swept the area with his eyes. The judge got out first and went ahead, and as Ryan caught up, he found himself walking on the man's left, half a step behind. It took a moment to remember that this instinctive action was exactly what the Marine Corps had taught him at Quantico was the proper way for a junior officer to accompany his betters. It forced Ryan to consider just how junior he was.
Ever been in here before, Jack?
No, sir, I haven't. Moore was amused.
That's right. You come from around here. Now, if you came from farther away, you'd have made the trip a few times.
A Marine guard held the door open for them. Inside, a Secret Service agent signed them in. Moore nodded and walked on.
Is this to be in the cabinet room, sir?
Uh-huh. Situation room, downstairs. It's more comfortable and better equipped for this sort of thing. The slides you need are already down there. All set up. Nervous?
Yes, sir. I sure am.
Moore chuckled.
Settle down, boy. The President has wanted to meet you for some time now. He liked the report on terrorism you did a few years back, and I've shown him some more of your work, and the one on Russian missile submarine operations, and the one you just did on management practices and their arms industries. All in all, I think you'll find he's a pretty regular guy. Just be ready when he asks questions. He'll hear every word you say, and he has a way of hitting you with good ones when he wants.
Moore turned to descend a staircase. Ryan followed him down 3 flights. Then they came to a door which led to a corridor. The judge turned left and walked to yet another door, this one guarded by another Secret Service agent.
Afternoon, Judge. The President will be down shortly.
Thank you. This is Dr. Ryan. I'll vouch for him.
Right. The agent waved them in.
It was not nearly as spectacular as Ryan had expected. The Situation Room was probably no larger than the Oval Office upstairs. There was expensive-looking wood paneling over what was probably concrete walls. This part of the White House dated back to the complete rebuilding job done under Truman. Ryan's lectern was to his left as he went in. It stood in front and slightly to the right of a roughly diamond-shaped table, and behind it was the projection screen. A note on the lectern said the slide projector in the middle of the table was ready loaded and focused and gave the order of the slides, which had been delivered from the National Reconnaissance Office. Most of the people were already here, all of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense. The Secretary of State, he remembered, was still shuttling back and forth between Athens and Ankara, trying to settle the latest Cyprus situation. This perennial thorn in NATO's southern flank had flared up a few weeks earlier when a Greek student had run over a Turkish child with his car and been killed by a gang minutes later. By the end of the day, 50 people had been injured, and the putatively allied countries were once more at each other's throats.
Now two American aircraft carriers were cruising the Aegean as the Secretary of State labored to calm both sides. It was bad enough that two young people had died, Ryan thought, but not something to get a country's army mobilized for. Also at the table were General Thomas Hilton, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Jeffrey Pelt, the president's national security advisor, a pompous man Ryan had met years before at Georgetown University's Center for Strategic and International Studies. Pelt was going through some papers and dispatches. The chiefs were chatting amicably among themselves when the commandant of the Marine Corps looked up and spotted Ryan. He got up and walked over.
"You Jack Ryan?" General David Maxwell asked.
Yes, sir. Maxwell was a short, tough fireplug of a man whose stubbly haircut seemed to spark with aggressive energy. He looked Ryan over before shaking hands.
"Pleased to meet you, son. I like what you did over in London. Good for the Corps."
He referred to the terrorist incident in which Ryan had very nearly been killed.
"That was good quick action you took, Lieutenant."
"Thank you, sir. I was lucky."
"Good officer's supposed to be lucky. I hear you got some interesting news for us."
"Yes, sir. I think you will find it worth your time."
"Nervous?"
The general saw the answer and smiled thinly.
"Relax, son. Everybody in this damn cellar puts his pants on the same way as you."
He backhanded Ryan to the stomach and went to his seat. The general whispered something to Admiral Daniel Foster, Chief of Naval Operations. The CNO looked Ryan over for a moment before going back to what he was doing. The president arrived a minute later. Everyone in the room stood as he walked to his chair, on Ryan's right. He said a few quick things to Dr. Pelt, then looked pointedly at the DCI.
"Gentlemen, if we can bring this meeting to order, I think Judge Moore has some news for us."
"Thank you, Mr. President. Gentlemen, we had an interesting development today with respect to the Soviet naval operation that started yesterday. I have asked Dr. Ryan here to deliver the briefing."
The president turned to Ryan. The younger man could feel himself being appraised.
"You may proceed."
Ryan took a sip of ice water from a glass hidden in the lectern. He had a wireless control for the slide projector and a choice of pointers. A separate high-intensity light illuminated his notes. The pages were full of errors and scribbled corrections. There had not been time to edit the copy.
"Thank you, Mr. President. Gentlemen, my name is Jack Ryan, and the subject of this briefing is recent Soviet naval activity in the North Atlantic. Before I get to that, it will be necessary for me to lay a little groundwork. I trust you will bear with me for a few minutes. And please feel free to interrupt with questions at any time." Ryan clicked on the slide projector. The overhead lights near the screen dimmed automatically.
"These photographs come to us courtesy of the British," Ryan said. He now had everyone's attention. "The ship you see here is the Soviet Fleet ballistic missile submarine, Red October, photographed by a British agent in her dock at her submarine base at Polyarny near Murmansk in northern Russia. As you can see, she is a very large vessel, about 650 feet long, a beam of roughly 85 feet, and an estimated submerged displacement of 32,000 tons. These figures are roughly comparable to those of a World War I battleship." Ryan lifted a pointer. "In addition to being considerably larger than our own Ohio-class Trident submarines, Red October has a number of technical differences. She carries 26 missiles instead of our 24. The earlier Typhoon-class vessels from which she was developed only have 20. October carried the new SSN-20 sea-launched ballistic missile, the Seahawk. It's a solid-fuel missile with a range of about 6,000 nautical miles, and it carries 8 multiple independently targetable re-entry vehicles, MIRVs, each with an estimated yield of 500 kilotons. It's the same RV carried by their SS-18s, but there are a lot less of them per launcher. As you can see, the missile tubes are located forward of the sail instead of aft, as in our subs. The forward diving planes fold into slots in the hull here. Ours go on the sail. She has twin screws, ours have one propeller, and finally, her hull is oblate, instead of being cylindrical like ours. It is flattened out markedly top and bottom." Ryan clicked to the next slide. It showed two views superimposed, bow over stern. "These frames were delivered to us undeveloped. They were processed by the National Reconnaissance Office. Please note the doors here at the bow and here at the stern. The British were a little puzzled by these, and that's why I was permitted to bring the shots over earlier this week. We weren't able to figure out their function at the CIA either,
and it was decided to seek the opinion of an outside consultant.
Who decided? The Secretary of Defense demanded angrily. Hell, I haven't even seen them yet.
We only got them Monday, Bert, Judge Moore replied soothingly. These two on the screen are only 4 hours old. Ryan suggested an outside expert, and James Greer approved it. I concurred.
His name is Oliver W. Tyler. Dr. Tyler is a former naval officer who is now Associate Professor of Engineering at the Naval Academy and a paid consultant to Sea Systems Command. He's an expert in the analysis of Soviet naval technology. Skip, Dr. Tyler, concluded that these doors are the intake and exhaust vents for a new silent propulsion system. He is currently developing a computer model of the system, and we hope to have this information by the end of the week. The system itself is rather interesting, Ryan explained Tyler's analysis briefly.
Okay, Dr. Ryan, the president leaned forward. You've just told us that the Soviets have built a missile submarine that's supposed to be hard for our men to locate. I don't suppose that's news. Go on.
Red October's captain is a man named Marco Ramius. That is a Lithuanian name, although we believe his internal passport designates his nationality as Great Russian. He is the son of a high party official, and as good a submarine commander as they have. He's taken out the lead ship of every Soviet submarine class for the past 10 years. Red October sailed last Friday. We do not know exactly what her orders were, but ordinarily their missile subs, that is, those with the newer, long-range missiles, confine their activities to the Barents Sea and adjacent areas in which they can be protected from our attack boats by land-based ASW aircraft, their own surface ships, and attack submarines. About noon local time on Sunday, we noted increased search activity in the Barents Sea. At the time, we took this to be a local ASW exercise, and by late Monday, it looked to be a test of October's new drive system. As you all know, early yesterday saw a vast increase in Soviet naval activity. Nearly all of the Blue Water ships assigned to their northern fleet are now at sea, accompanied by all of their fast fleet replenishment vessels. Additional fleet auxiliaries sailed from the Baltic fleet bases and the Western Mediterranean. Even more disquieting is the fact that nearly every nuclear submarine assigned to the northern fleet, their largest, appears to be heading into the North Atlantic. This includes three from the Med, since submarines there come from the Northern Fleet, not the Black Sea Fleet. Now, we think we know why this all happened. Ryan clicked to the next slide. This one showed the North Atlantic, from Florida to the Pole, with Soviet ships marked in red. The day Red October sailed, Captain Ramius evidently posted a letter to Admiral Yuri Ilyich Podorin. Podorin is chief of the main political administration of their navy. We do not know what the letter said, but here we can see its results. This began to happen not 4 hours after that letter was opened. 58 nuclear-powered submarines and 28 major surface combatants all headed our way. This is a remarkable reaction in 4 hours. This morning, we learned what their orders are. Gentlemen, these ships have been ordered to locate Red October and, if necessary, to sink her. Ryan paused for effect. As you can see, the Soviet surface force is here, about halfway between the European mainland and Iceland. Their submarines, these in particular, are all heading southwest towards the U.S. coast. Please note, there is no unusual activity on the Pacific side of either country, except we have information that Soviet fleet ballistic missile submarines in both oceans are being recalled to port. Therefore, while we do not know exactly what Captain Ramius said, we can draw some conclusions from these patterns of activity. It would appear that they think he's heading in our direction. Given his estimated speed as something between 10 and 30 knots, he could be anywhere from here, below Iceland, to here, just off our coast. You will note that in either case, he has successfully avoided detection by all four of these SOSUS barriers.
Wait a minute. You say they have issued orders to their ships to sink one of their own submarines?
Yes, Mr. President. The President looked at the DCI.
This is reliable information, Judge?
Yes, Mr. President, we believe it to be solid.
Okay, Dr. Ryan. We're all waiting. What's this Ramius fellow up to?
Mr. President, our evaluation of this intelligence data is that Red October is attempting to defect to the United States. The room went very quiet for a moment. Ryan could hear the whirring of the fan in the slide projector, as the National Security Council pondered that.
he held his hands on the lectern to keep them from shaking under the stare of the 10 men in front of him.
"That's a very interesting conclusion, Doctor," the President smiled. "Defend it."
"Mr. President, no other conclusion fits the data. The really crucial thing, of course, is the recall of their other missile boats. They've never done that before. Add to that the fact that they have issued orders to sink their newest and most powerful missile sub, and that they're chasing in this direction, and one is left with the conclusion that they think she has left the reservation and is heading this way."
"Very well. What else could it be?"
"Sir, he could have told them that he's going to fire his missiles at us, at them, the Chinese, or just about anyone else."
"And you don't think so?"
"No, Mr. President. The SS M-20 has a range of 6,000 miles. That means he could have hit any target in the Northern Hemisphere from the moment he left the dock. He's had 6 days to do that, but he has not fired. Moreover, if he had threatened to launch his birds, he would have to consider the possibility that the Soviets would enlist our assistance to locate and sink him. After all, if our surveillance systems detect the launch of nuclear-armed missiles in any direction, things could get very tense, very quickly.
You know he could fire his birds in both directions and start World War III, the Secretary of Defense observed.
"Yes, Mr. Secretary. In that case, we'd be dealing with a total madman. More than one, in fact. On our missile boats, there are 5 officers who must all agree and act in unison to fire their missiles. The Soviets have the same number. For political reasons, their nuclear warhead security procedures are even more elaborate than ours. 5 or more people, all of whom wish to end the world?" Ryan shook his head. "That seems most unlikely, sir. And again, the Soviets would be well advised to inform us and enlist our aid."
"Do you really think they would inform us?" Dr. Pelt asked. His tone indicated what he thought.
"Sir, that's more a psychological question than a technical one, and I deal principally with technical intelligence. Some of the men in this room have met their Soviet counterparts and are better equipped to answer that than I am. My answer to your question, however, is yes. That would be the only rational thing for them to do. And while I do not regard the Soviets as entirely rational by our standards, they are rational by their own. They are not given to this sort of high-stakes gambling."
"Who is?" the President observed.
"What else might it be?"
"Several things, sir. It could simply be a major naval exercise aimed at testing their ability to close our sea lines of communication and our ability to respond, both on short notice. We reject this possibility for several reasons. It's too soon after their autumn naval exercise, Crimson Storm, and they're only using nuclear submarines. No diesel-powered boats seem to be involved. Clearly, speed is at a premium in their operation. And as a practical matter, they do not run major exercises at this time of year."
"And why is that?" the President asked.
Admiral Foster answered for Ryan.
"Mr. President, the weather up there at this time of year is extremely bad. Even we don't schedule exercises under these conditions."
"I seem to recall we just ran a NATO exercise, Admiral," Pelt noted.
"Yes, sir, south of Bermuda, where the weather's a lot nicer. Except for an anti-sub exercise off the British Isles, all of Nifty Dolphin was held on our side of the lake."
"Okay, let's get back to what else their fleet might be up to," the President ordered.
"Well, sir, it might not be an exercise at all. It could be the real thing. This could be the beginning of a conventional war against NATO. Its first step being interdiction of the sea lines of communication. If so, they've achieved complete strategic surprise and are now throwing it away by operating so overtly that we cannot fail to notice or react forcefully. Moreover, there is no corresponding activity whatever in their other armed services. Their army and air force, except for maritime surveillance aircraft and the Pacific Fleet, are engaged in routine training operations. Finally, this could be an attempt to provoke or divert us, drawing our attention to this while they are preparing to spring a surprise somewhere else. If so, they're going about it in a strange way. If you try to provoke somebody, you don't do it in his front yard. The Atlantic, Mr. President, is still our ocean. As you can see from this chart, we have allies on both sides of the ocean, and we can establish air superiority over the entire Atlantic if we so choose. Their navy is numerically large, larger than ours in some critical areas, but they cannot project force as well as we can. Not yet, anyway. And certainly not right off our coast. Ryan took a sip of water.
So,
Gentlemen, we have a Soviet missile submarine at sea when all the others in both oceans are being recalled. We have their fleet at sea with orders to sink that sub, and evidently they are chasing it in our direction. As I said, this is the only conclusion that fits the data.
How many men on the sub, Doctor? The President asked.
We believe 110 or so, sir.
So, 110 men all decide to defect to the United States at one time.
Not an altogether bad idea, the President observed dryly, but hardly a likely one.
Ryan was ready for that.
There is precedent for this, sir. On November 8, 1975, the Storshevoy, a Soviet Krivak-class missile frigate, attempted to run from Riga, Latvia, to the Swedish island of Gotland. The political officer aboard, Valery Sablin, led a mutiny of the enlisted personnel. They locked their officers in their cabins and raced away from the dock. They came close to making it. Air and fleet units attacked them and forced them to halt within 50 miles of Swedish territorial waters. Two more hours and they would have made it. Sablin and 26 other officers were court-martialed and shot. More recently, we've had reports of mutinous episodes on several Soviet vessels, especially submarines. In 1980, an Echo-class Soviet attack submarine surfaced off Japan. The captain claimed to have had a fire aboard, but photographs taken by naval reconnaissance aircraft, ours and Japanese, did not show smoke or fire-damaged debris being jettisoned from the submarine. However, the crewmen on deck did show sufficient evidence of trauma to support the conclusion that a riot had taken place aboard. We have had similar, sketchier reports for some years now. While I admit this is an extreme example, our conclusion is decidedly not without precedent. Admiral Foster reached inside his jacket and came out with a plastic-tipped cigar. His eyes sparkled behind the match.
You know, I could almost believe this.
Then I wish you'd tell us all why, Admiral, the President said, because I still don't.
Mr. President, most mutinies are led by officers, not enlisted men. The reason for this is simply that the enlisted men do not know how to navigate the ship. Moreover, officers have the advantages and educational background to know that successful rebellion is a possibility. Both of these factors would be even more true in the Soviet Navy. What if just the officers are doing this?
And the rest of the crew is going along with them, Pelt asked, knowing what would happen to them and their families.
Foster puffed a few times on his cigar.
Ever been to sea, Dr. Pelt?
No.
Let's imagine for a moment that you're taking a world cruise on the Queen Elizabeth II, say. One fine day you're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. But how do you know exactly where you are?
You don't know.
You know what the officers tell you.
Oh, sure, if you know a little astronomy, you might be able to estimate your latitude to within a few hundred miles. With a good watch and some knowledge of spherical trigonometry, you might even guess your longitude to within a few hundred, okay?
That's on a ship that you can see from.
These guys are on a submarine. You can't see a whole lot. Now what if the officers, not even all the officers, are doing this?
How will the crew know what's going on?
Foster shook his head.
They won't. They can't. Even our guys might not, and our men are trained a lot better than theirs.
Their seamen are nearly all conscripts, remember. On a nuclear submarine, you're absolutely cut off from the outside world. No radios except for ELF and VLF, and that's all encrypted. Messages have to come through the communications officer. So he has to be in on it. Same thing with the boat's navigator. They use inertial navigation systems, same as us. We have one of theirs, from that gold we lifted off Hawaii. In their machine, the data is also encrypted. The quartermaster reads the numbers off the machine, and the navigator gets their position from a book. In the Red Army, on land, maps are classified documents. Same thing in their Navy. The enlisted men don't get to see charts and are not encouraged to know where they are. This would be especially true on missile submarines, right? On top of all that, these guys are working sailors, nukes. When you're at sea, you have a job to do, and you do it. On their ships, that means from 14 to 18 hours a day. These kids are all draftees with very simple training. They're taught to perform one or two tasks and to follow their orders exactly. The Soviets train people to do their jobs by rote, with as little thinking as possible. That's why on major repair jobs, you see officers holding tools.
their men will have neither the time nor the inclination to question their officers about what's going on. You do your job, and depend on everybody else to do his. That's what discipline at sea is about." Foster tapped his cigar ash into an ashtray.